You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll get the results from a new Marquette Law School poll. It asked Wisconsinites about the presidential election, mask mandates, Black Lives Matter protests, and more. First, a lot of fun activities may be off the table right now, but the good news is we can still enjoy the outdoors. And a five-year project in Milwaukee has gotten a beach ready for everyone to enjoy it. Bradford Beach on the Lake Michigan shoreline is now seen as one of the most accessible beaches in the country, maybe the most. Damian Bookman is the founder and executive director of the Ability Center. Damian, welcome back to the show.
Hey, thanks so much for having me. It's a pleasure.
Well, we checked in with you last year, Damian, when this project was underway. Now, paint us a picture. What does Bradford Beach look like, especially when it comes to accessibility?
Well, to put it in the simplest terms, it's now open for everybody. So before we did this, the Oak Leaf Trail ended at the side of the beach for most of the public impacted by disabilities. But now we've actually opened it that continues a walk in seasonal mat that takes you all the way down to the water.
Talk about the process that got us here, Damian.
Yeah, you know, our organization, the Ability Center, wanted to get more involved in the community and actually start making changes so that recreation was inclusive for everybody, and not just the individual with a disability, but their families. And so we started in 2015 by putting just beach chairs at Bradford Beach. And we said that we promised at that time that we would open Bradford Beach with a more permanent structure. It took a little bit longer than we expected after I had a few surgeries of my own and adopted a couple of kids, but we were here in time and in honor of the 30th anniversary of the ADA to turn Bradford Beach into the country's most accessible.
And spell out for us some of the changes you've made at the beach to make it as accessible as it is now.
So, you know, what we're telling people to help everybody understand is that it's more about what it isn't than what it is. And what I mean by that is, it isn't just a switchback ramp that looks like it's only for people with disabilities, and that's not the presentation and experience that we want people to have. And so it's concrete, and it's concrete because if you build a wooden boardwalk, that feels like a rumble strip to someone who's in a chair or especially a power wheelchair. And so it's not that, it's concrete. And it's not the minimal ADA guidelines of 5.5 feet wide, it's 8 feet wide to, for easy access to and fro, and nobody feels like they need to be in the way. And it's not just a ramp, it's also a set of steps so that it's fully inclusive. And then again, the mat that we put, not every beach takes that all the way down to the water, but we did. And you could also have chosen between a 5 foot mat, seasonal mat, or a 6.5 foot wide seasonal mat. And again, we went with 6.5 feet wide for ease of traffic and comfort and feeling welcome when you get there. And then finally, which is of course the most important, is we added beach wheelchairs down there that are free to check out. And in beach towns across the country, you might find one or two. We placed four, and sometimes you have to pay to rent them. Thanks to the DOC and the Milwaukee County Parks down at Bradford Beach, they are free to check out.
And I know there's a distinction kind of between accessible and, you know, meeting the required standards and fun and inviting. Can you talk about the importance of making sure we have spaces that go beyond just that bare minimum?
Yeah, like I said earlier, I mean, it can't be understated that people, we all go places where we feel welcome, wanted, and comfortable, where we feel that we've been thought of and we've been brought in and our considerations have been taken into account. And that, again, is what we did here by not going with a minimalist approach, but going with, you know, kind of a universal and much more inclusive approach. We will often say that access does not equal opportunity. Access often means I can get in the door, but do I have the full range of opportunities that an able-bodied individual does? And that's the solution we created at Bradford Beach. I visited Clearwater Beach late last year, and I realized that they were checking out beach wheelchairs for $30 an hour. That means that you're basically punished if you have a disability because the able-bodied public doesn't have to pay to access the beach. And then the chair also was not an independent chair that could be pushed on your own. You had to have somebody that was there with you to push it. So should you be traveling by yourself, you still wouldn't have even been able to access the beach. And we took even, again, that into consideration to make sure that these chairs could be pushed either manually or they can be powered by someone else if you have that capacity.
We're talking to Damian Bookman, founder and executive director of the Ability Center, about a project to make Milwaukee's Bradford Beach not just accessible to people with different abilities, but fun and inviting to everyone. And Damon, you mentioned the able-bodied community. You make a point of pointing out that, you know, in a lot of ways, we're temporarily able-bodied. What do you mean by that phrase?
Absolutely. Every single one of us belongs to a group that we call TABS, which stands for temporarily able-bodied. So whether it is disease or it is accident or it's the aging process, we are all going to have a need for greater access in the future due to, diminishing ability, diminishing mobility. And so some of the significant comments we actually got when we did open this, or when we were under construction and posting it on social media, were people that were saying, I can't wait to bring my mom down. I can't bring my dad down. They grew up on that beach and they haven't been able to access it for, you know, decades. And so our desire to continue to do the recreational things that we grew up loving, you know, from birth, you know, through death to some degree, we always want to continue to do those, but we start to lose that. And so that opportunity, again, is now there, multi-generational, and really for anybody, wherever you're at. And I learned that when I was 13 and 14, when I was diagnosed with bone cancer. I went from 1 minute being an athlete and completely able-bodied to literally in crutches and a knee immobilizer and orthopedic mobility impairment for the rest of my life.
Now that it is operational, what kind of things are you hearing from people about Bradford Beach?
I think people are loving it. You know, one of the things that I try to help people understand is there's an economic impact here when you make things inclusive. It is said that 26% of Americans report a disability. And so there's a large contingency out there that still want to be active if you provide that for them. And we got a great email from the doc that said, hey, we really appreciate you connecting the Moby mat to the Tiki Hut. We've already seen people in chairs using it. So they are out there spending their money and consuming as everybody else would if they were given the opportunity, which they were in this case.
This is one beach. Are you working on other projects, and are you hoping to inspire other people, maybe in other communities, to do similar things?
Well, hey, listen, we laid the gauntlet by saying that this is America's most accessible beach. I'm 99% confident that we're right, but I also welcome anybody to do better, and we're happy to help you do so and put you on the top of that mountain. If that challenge laid that has been laid gets people to do better in their communities anywhere across the country, then certainly we have begun to fulfill our mission even greater.
And can you talk about, I know we've talked to you in the past about, I think, some indoor activities as well for when, you know, the beach isn't so inviting in a Wisconsin winter. Are you seeing good developments on, you know, things like adaptive fitness and sports?
We definitely are. I'm also the founder of the Wisconsin Adaptive Sports Association, no longer involved, but had founded that organization. But as we're staring down the current pandemic, a lot of people are being pushed outside, and we may very well be continued to be pushed outside for activity in the winter. And not everything is open for people with disabilities. In fact, minimal parks are, minimal trails are, minimal beaches are, minimal ski hills are. The opportunities are not anywhere near the same. So it's vitally important that we continue to ramp up more and more destinations. And one of the greatest achievements in the beach as well that I would say is that the chairs that we put down there are multi all year use. So all simply by swapping out wheels, they'll be able to be used in the parks and trails in the future, and they'll be able to be used with skis in the winter so that they can be multi-use all year round and not just functional during the summer season.
As we wrap up, if someone's listening in another community, Damian, and they're thinking, yeah, I want to do something, you know, like Bradford Beach or, you know, a comparable project, what advice would you have for them on getting it rolling?
Call me. Tim Oknikowski, who was actually injured, paralyzed, became a quadriplegic at Bradford Beach in Lake Michigan when he was 17, just retired from the Milwaukee County Office for Persons with Disabilities. And their mission there was to make Milwaukee County the most accessible and inclusive county in the country. Tim, at that time, when we opened at Bradford Beach, mentioned, you know, that he thought Damian, myself, was one of the most visionary people he's ever met. I don't think in the space of ADA compliance, we think in the space of universal opportunity and universal community. And so we always go outside of the box, and we're happy to help any community anywhere ramp up any project that they're looking at.
Damian, thanks a lot for joining us again today.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me. It's my pleasure.
Damian Bookman is founder and executive director of the Ability Center. He joined us for a look at Milwaukee's Bradford Beach and the project that made it more accessible than maybe any other beach in the whole country. Coming up, the new Marquette Law School poll of Wisconsinites shows a clear opinion when it comes to mask mandates. We'll get the details and other results coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, our week in Washington looks at Joe Biden's vice presidential pick, stalled coronavirus relief from Congress, and some primary results from around the country. First, a new Marquette Law School poll is out with questions for Wisconsinites about the presidential election, mask mandates, support for Black Lives Matter protests, and more. The poll was conducted August 4th to 9th. Results were released yesterday. Charles Franklin is professor of law and public policy at Marquette University and director of the Marquette Law School poll. Charles, welcome back to the show.
Thanks. Good to be back.
We'll start us off with the matchup in the presidential race here in Wisconsin. What are we looking at?
Well, this month we're switching to likely voters instead of all registered voters. And we see a 5-point Biden lead, 49-44. In June with likely voters, it was a 6-point lead, 50-44. So a 1-point change. The margin of error here is 4.2 percentage points. So that's a very small change, maybe a slight tightening. When we look at all registered voters, that was an 8-point lead in June and a 6-point lead now. So a 2-point change. So I think between those two, you might say the race has tightened just a little bit, but it's almost within rounding error. I wouldn't reach large conclusions about a change of 1 percentage point.
Now, is it just me, Charles, or is there a lot more presidential polling of Wisconsin this year? Yours, of course. There's one at UW-Madison, and it seems like some of the nationals are paying more attention to us this time around.
Yeah, I think 2016 taught national pollsters they shouldn't ignore us. It's great to have UW-Madison doing their polling as well, because that gets us a second look from inside the state, where I'd like to believe we're a little more familiar with the details of politics here. So it's really good, and it also means that readers, viewers, listeners can, you know, get multiple takes on this. And so all of this is to the good that we have more polling.
One thing that struck me in the race was the you asked about voter enthusiasm, in effect. And I know we've seen arguments from the Trump campaign saying, yeah, the polls, we're behind in some polls, but look at enthusiasm. Our voters are way more excited than Biden supporters. What did you get when you asked people about that?
Yeah, this is one where we don't see any difference in enthusiasm or commitment to voting. For people saying they're certain to vote, Democrats and Republicans are exactly the same. Independents a good deal less likely to be certain. If you're very excited about voting in November, Democrats and Republicans are the same. Independents a bit less excited. What the Trump campaign and some media outlets have stressed is if you ask, how excited are you to vote for Donald Trump, or how excited are you to vote for Joe Biden, in those national polls, Trump voters are more excited to vote for him than Biden supporters are to vote for Biden. And so there is some truth to this argument about enthusiasm, but in our data, it has nothing to do with how likely you are to actually turn out, but the fact that Trump voters are particularly positive about him and Biden voters don't share that same level of commitment to him, at least not at this point. On the other hand, the Biden voters are pretty negative to Donald Trump. So there's also a flip side to that.
This is still, of course, a few months out from elections. These polls seem pretty consistent. 5-ish point leads for Biden in Wisconsin. I'm guessing, though, we're not going to see Democrats put this one in their pockets or Republicans throw in the towel on Wisconsin just yet.
Well, no one should do that, and for two reasons. One is we certainly saw the polls, including mine, were wrong. We had Clinton up by 6. Before the election last time. So why on earth would you believe me? But secondly, Polls don't vote. It's the people that vote. Go to the polls and vote for whoever you want to vote for, or vote for a third party, or stay home. That's entirely up to the voters. But it's important to realize that the outcome of the race lies in the hands of the voters, not in the hands of the pollsters or the poll results.
Talking to Charles Franklin with the Marquette Law School poll, looking at the results of their latest survey of Wisconsin out this week. Let's turn to some other issues now. We've got a statewide mask mandate, at least for now, from the governor. You asked people about that, the mandate for masks in indoor public places. What did people think?
People are pretty positive about it. The governor had announced this in the week before we did the poll. 69% supported a mask mandate. 29% were opposed. There was a party divide. Democrats were 93% in favor and independents 71%. But Republicans were fairly divided, 43 in favor, 54 opposed. Often we see Democrats at 90 to something for something and Republicans 90 to something against it, or vice versa. But here, that relatively even split among the Republicans is why we see a, you know, nearly 70% majority in favor, is because Republicans are more or less divided while independents are lopsided and Democrats nearly unanimous. Also, as a result of that, the mask mandate is supported by a solid majority in every region of the state, including the rural Northwest.
Are there differences in geographical support, or is that consistently favored by the same margins?
No, the size varies a little bit. In the city of Milwaukee, it's 83% in favor. In the Wow counties, or the surrounding suburbs, more than just the Wow counties, 64 in favor. Madison, 78. Green Bay, 73. And the north and west, that's Wausau over to the Twin Cities, 60% in favor.
You also ask, as you do, about support for Governor Evers, how he's doing on the job, and how he's handling COVID in particular. What did you find out about attitudes toward the governor?
On COVID, there's a little uptick, perhaps connected with that broad support for the mask order. 61% approve of his handling of COVID, 35 disapprove. That's up 3 points from 58-37 in June. In March, he was very high at 76-17. That fell off down to 64 and then 58, but now rebounds to 61 this month. His overall job approval is a little lower than that, 57 approve, 37 disapprove, but that's also up 3 points from June.
And how did survey respondents assess the president's handling of the coronavirus pandemic?
That's actually been working its way down. This month, 40% approve of the president's handling of the epidemic, 58% disapprove. In June, it was 44-52. It was also 44 in May. The high watermark was in March, really at the start of the shutdown, when the president's job approval was at 51% on handling COVID. So that's come down a solid 11 points over time. As I say, Evers has come down as well, but at a much higher level, and now a little rebound for him, while the president's approval on this issue has dropped 4 points.
One more issue I want to get to that you asked about. Back in June, the killing of George Floyd by Minneapolis police, the resulting Black Lives Matter protests, it's still very recent in a lot of ways. What have we seen in the movement of public opinion toward those protests here in Wisconsin?
Here we have seen a drop in support for the protests. In June, 61% approved, 36 disapproved. In August, it's 48-48, a dead even split. And so there has been a drop in support. The drop is largest among white respondents, who came down from 59 approved to 45 approved. Black and Hispanic support is largely unchanged from where it was a month ago. Also, President Trump's job approval on the protests has hardly changed. 30% approved of him in June on handling the protests. It's 32% this time. So even though support for the protests came down, it doesn't appear to have affected the president's evaluation on that issue.
Bringing things back around to the presidential race, are we able to tell if either of these huge stories, the COVID pandemic and the Black Lives Matter protests, are affecting people's thoughts on who they're going to vote for president?
Well, I think we've seen little movement in the presidential race. In February, it was tied. In March and May, it was about a 3-point margin. And then it moved up to 6 points in June and 5 points this month if we switch to likely voters. So it's maybe Biden's margin has grown a little bit from February, but we're not seeing a steady change, and this month tightened by 1 percentage point. So I think we're still looking at a competitive race, but it's not at the exactly even level either. These are small margins for Biden, but they are certainly not prohibitive margins. More to the point, all of this and the things that we've been talking about are a look at where the public stands today and what they think and what issues are bothering them. These are not forecasts of what will happen in November because things could change. If 2020 has taught us anything, it should be that we don't know what's going to happen next.
The 2016, yeah. In our last 30 seconds or so, Charles, one thing that's new since you were in the field with this, we have a vice presidential nominee to go along with Joe Biden here. Historically, do we see a nomination, a selection of a VP candidate bump polls much at all?
Usually it doesn't, though almost always it's conflated with the party conventions, because you usually roll out your vice presidential pick right about the same time as the conventions. And so knowing how much of the effect was the VP as opposed to the conventions is always hard to tell. I think the importance of the vice president is what they do within the party in terms of important coalitions and whether they unify voices within the party or whether they form the basis for some kind of dissent. And then outside the party, is the vice presidential pick someone who is seen as qualified and able to perform the duties of the office as well as potentially the presidency?
Charles, thanks again for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thank you.
That's Charles Franklin from Marquette University talking with the latest Marquette Law School survey. Check out the full results at WPR.org/Central Time. Stick around, there's more to come here on the Ideas Network. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, we'll check in on results from primary elections yesterday for states in the state in the state legislature and Congress. Plus, we'll look ahead at the races they set up for November. First, it's the week in Washington, and we're looking at some of the top stories making news in the nation's capital. Senator Kamala Harris, Democrat from California, is Joe Biden's pick to run with him for the White House against Donald Trump and Mike Pence. Harris has been seen as the front runner for the spot for some time and is the first black woman and woman of Indian descent to be on a major party's presidential ticket. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What is your reaction to Biden's choice of Kamala Harris as running mate? Did you follow her campaign for president? What questions do you have about her as a candidate for vice president? Do you think Biden made the right call? How do you think Republicans could or should respond? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll take a look at that story and more with Andy Duren, congressional reporter for The Wall Street Journal. Andy, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Well, a lot of drama, Andy, to end up with a person who I think a lot of people thought we'd end up with here, right?
Yeah, I don't think this was much of a surprise pick for anyone. I mean, soon after Senator Harris dropped out of the presidential race last year, Vice President Biden said that she was someone he might pick as a running mate. So this has really been months of foreshadowing here leading up to this. So, yeah, no surprises here in Washington.
Let's give a listen to a tweet from the Biden campaign of the likely presidential nominee and the vice presidential nominee about taking the job. Here's a listen.
First of all, is the answer yes?
The answer is absolutely yes, Joe, and I am ready to work. I am ready to do this with you, for you. I'm just deeply honored, and I'm very excited.
and there's a more formal public event going on today. What are some of the pros and cons people are looking at, Andy, for Kamala Harris as a running mate?
I think there are a few things that Democrats have are excited about with Senator Harris. I think, first of all, you know, there is the historic nature of her candidacy. As we mentioned, she is the first Black woman and the first woman of Asian descent and the first woman or would be the first woman to be vice president of the United States. So there are a few kind of historic demographic reasons that folks are excited about her. But beyond that, I think Senator Harris is seen as someone in the party who complements a lot of complements Joe Biden in a few different ways. You know, she was someone who during her time in the Senate has had a real appetite and flair for kind of viral moments, for really hammering folks from the Trump administration in hearings and other forums in ways that kind of lifted her star and gained a lot of attention. So I think there's a lot of excitement around her ability to bring that kind of energy to the ticket and that kind of maybe, you know, public persona and speaking ability to the ticket. So I think those are some of the things that, you know, Senator Harris early on here, people are excited about, Democrats are excited about. I think another thing too is she does not pose a major liability to Vice President Biden. She is not someone that is really ripe for attacks from Republicans, that she is some, you know, extremist, far left radical. Obviously, this is something that Republicans already have and will try and tag her with, but she's not someone who has the reputation that some of the other people who are under consideration did in terms of being a little bit more ideological or progressive. So those are kind of the some of the major points right now, I think, in Senator Harris's column.
I want to give a listen to President Trump talking about Kamala Harris from the White House briefing room shortly after the pick became public. The president had referred to the senator as nasty for the way she questioned how now Supreme Court Justice Brett Kavanaugh was questioned during his confirmation hearings. Here's a listen.
She's also known, from what I understand, as being just about the most liberal person in the U.S. Senate. And I would have thought that Biden would have tried to stay away from that a little bit, because with what they're doing with open borders and sanctuary cities, where they're trying to protect sanctuary cities, which is also protecting large number of criminals, with all of the things that they're doing, Second Amendment, they want to take away your Second Amendment or modify it to a point where it's essentially no longer the Second Amendment. I would have thought he would have gone a different way.
Those are similar things that what you might expect from President Trump, regardless of the vice presidential pick, right?
Yeah, I think that's like you said, it is generic to a certain extent. I mean, those are attacks that would be levied and will be levied at Democrats overall in the election season here. But, you know, unlike someone like, you know, an alternative like Senator Elizabeth Warren or Representative Karen Bass, you know, those are two people who have, you know, a longer career in kind of progressive policy spaces and are someone in candidates or they were, you know, possible choices that would have been, you know, a bigger target, I guess, for Republicans in terms of, you know, policy proposals that they would have said are kind of outside the mainstream and too radical for the United States.
We're talking to Andy Duren, congressional reporter for The Wall Street Journal. It's our weekly look at some of the latest stories in national politics. Right now, looking at the Democratic vice presidential pick, Senator Kamala Harris. You can join in with your reaction right now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller now. Nancy is with us in Milwaukee. Nancy, hi.
Hello. I feel that she is just absolutely a wonderful mate for Biden. I feel that she's vibrant, she's smart, she speaks well. I think he couldn't have chosen a better person. And I think that Trump himself is so desperate at this point, he's going to try one of three things to counter the fact that she's been chosen. He's either going to push forward with the vaccine so that he can come off as looking like Mr. Wonderful, who has saved America, or he's going to drop out of the race entirely and simply walk away and say fake media is so terrible I can't even run anymore.
Nancy, thanks a lot for the call. That last one anyway seems like a long shot. But talk a little bit about the response. There are definitely people out there on the Democratic side like Nancy, Andy, pretty enthusiastic about the selection of Kamala Harris.
Yeah, I mean, I think, the Biden campaign said yesterday that they raised a record amount of money over, I think it was, a few hours. It was a major fundraising time for them. So this is a selection that is being greeted with a lot of enthusiasm by a lot of Democrats. And I think that's something that, Democrats in general, I mean, one of the things that stood out about the primary election, which obviously Senator Harris participated in, is that, all of the candidates or many of the candidates, obviously people had their preferences, but Democrats in general were relatively enthusiastic about all of the Democrats or many of the Democrats who ran for president. And there does just seem to be a general energy around the ticket overall.
Right. There is the question of the more progressive wing of the Democratic Party disappointed by, a centrist like Hillary Clinton picking a centrist-ish Democrat like Tim Kaine. There were progressives hoping to have somebody further to the left than Kamala Harris. Do you see potential for division like we saw in 2016 this time around?
I think there's certainly the potential for that kind of division. And there are certainly conversations among people on the left about that dynamic you described. But I don't think, at least so far, I haven't seen and I haven't heard some of the kind of more public, pushback and vitriol around this around Biden's campaign and Biden's candidacy, like you did maybe in 2016. I think that there is, that defeating Donald Trump is a really powerful unifying force for Democrats right now. And I think certainly there are Democrats who would have preferred a more progressive or maybe a more liberal selection. I think that right now, certainly Senator Harris is not a drag for Joe Biden in that sense, in terms of I think folks who are of the more progressive persuasion are pretty motivated or seem pretty motivated to defeat Donald Trump.
Thanks for that call, Nancy, at 800-642-1234. We're talking to Andy Duren, congressional reporter for The Wall Street Journal. It's the week in Washington. We're looking at a few of the stories making headlines in national politics. You can join in at 800-642-1234 if you have more reactions to the selection of a running mate for Joe Biden, Senator Kamala Harris. We'll also be talking about a bigger picture, how the vice presidential role has changed over the years. That's coming up later in the show. Also coming up in the week in Washington, still no relief package, no new relief package from Congress when it comes to COVID-19 and the economic damage. Are you hoping to see something? If so, what? 800-642-1234 is the number. That's 800-642-1234. We'll pick up the conversation coming up here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk with Wall Street Journal congressional reporter Andy Duren, looking at some of the top national political stories in the news this week. Let's move on to Congress and the ongoing stalemate, Andy, over another round of COVID economic relief. What are the latest happenings or maybe non-happenings?
Yeah, I think there are definitely more non-happenings than happenings right now. I mean, the very latest is that Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin called House Speaker Nancy Pelosi today saying that he wants to restart in-person negotiations over another relief bill. Those negotiations ended, or at least briefly ended, on Friday after Republicans and Democrats were unable to reach an agreement. But Speaker Pelosi said that she did not want to meet with Secretary Mnuchin or other folks from the administration because she doesn't think that Republicans are willing to spend, or she still does not think that Republicans are willing to spend what she sees as the necessary amount on the next bill. She wants Republicans to commit to essentially spending at least $2 trillion. They've proposed something in the realm of $1 trillion. Democrats are looking at something that's more than $3 trillion. And so Democrats right now are saying that they should meet in the middle and that Republicans should, up their ante and Democrats will lower their ante. But so far, the Trump administration and congressional Republicans have not been willing to go up to that level yet. And so we are where we are still.
And the president did these executive orders. You know, that's a limited power. It tackles some of the issues that Congress is working on, certainly not all of them. Is there any indication that that's either moving people to try to make a deal or telling some people, okay, he did that, we don't need a deal anymore?
I think it's taken a little bit of pressure off in some senses. I mean, what President Trump did over the weekend will not have or has not had any immediate impact on the his jobless aid order may or executive action on jobless aid may, you know, eventually start paying out some things to some employment assistance to folks. But in general, both sides still want to do something by legislation, and they both acknowledge that executive actions are no replacement for legislation. There's a whole laundry list of policy topics that the executive actions didn't address or even try and address, things like funding for schools, things like funding for vaccines, things like aid for small businesses. So there's a bipartisan desire to pass legislation. But so far, the issues over what that exact legislation should look like exactly remain too broad. And so there's been a little bit of impetus with the executive actions, but not enough, I guess, to really get things going.
It's our week in Washington. We are talking about some of the big news in national politics with Andy Duren from the Wall Street Journal. We invited your calls and reactions to the selection of Senator Kamala Harris as the Democratic vice presidential candidate, presumptive, I guess, until the convention. Let's bring out a couple more callers now. Jeff is with us in Superior. Jeff, hi.
Yeah, thank you. I actually plan to vote for Trump, but this election will help Biden win the Electoral College. They may flip Missouri, but I think they definitely will flip Michigan, Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, Florida, and that gives Biden the electoral victory. That's all they need to do, and this helps them secure that because she's perceived as a African-American woman, but she's not, but she's a person of color, and she will get there are more women in the United States than men, so I mean, they will get a good turnout, and the Democrats, I think, will win this election.
Jeff, thanks for the call. So reaching out to key demographic groups, Jeff says, in key swing states, Andy.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's certainly what the Biden campaign is hoping. I'm sure that they are very hopeful that they will win those key swing states. As Jeff mentioned, I think, you know, unlike, I guess, some historical vice presidential picks, though, Senator Harris's selection is a little different in that she is not from any of those swing states. You know, historically, kind of the old model of vice presidential picks is you would pick someone from a state, you know, who represented a state or was from a state that you wanted to win. And, you know, California is somewhere that, you know, Biden can pretty comfortably predict that he'll win. So it will be interesting to see, you know, if and how, you know, Senator Harris, you know, can motivate maybe certain groups of voters or appeal to certain groups of voters. But in that sense, she's also maybe an untraditional pick.
Thanks, Jeff. We'll go to Cyril now in Madison. Cyril, hi.
Hello.
What'd you want to bring up?
Yeah, I just wanted to bring up one point that maybe hasn't been emphasized too much is that she is the daughter of parents from different countries and different cultures. That makes her a first generation American, and that may have a lot of appeal to people who are interested in the issue of immigration and developing a fair immigration policy.
Thanks a lot for that call, Cyril. And I think, Andy, there's a classic version of a political story in America, like, you know, child of immigrants made good. Is that a theme you think we'll be hearing a lot?
I think that's certainly something we can expect, you know, as the Biden-Harris campaign begins to really, you know, sell the public or pitch the public on Senator Harris and Senator Biden. I'm sure we'll hear a lot about her, you know, her family's background. And I think in general, you know, Biden had said that he would pick a woman for his vice president. And I think in general, you know, both in the presidential election and even beyond that in congressional races, Democrats have sought to draw a contrast between their slate of candidates across the board and the demographics of those candidates in terms of having many more women who run as Democrats, having many more people of color who run as Democrats than Republicans who are, you know, predominantly a party populated by white men. And so I'm sure that that's kind of, whether that's an explicit contrast or a kind of an unspoken contrast that Democrats are drawing between, you know, their ticket, which does include a woman of color, and then the Republican ticket, which is two white men.
Thanks a lot for your calls. Before we run out of time, Andy, I want to talk about yesterday's primary elections. We'll talk about some of Wisconsin's coming up in a few. But there were a couple congressional races that got a lot of attention, one Republican, one Democrat. Let's start in Georgia and this Republican primary. What came out there and why are people focused on it?
So, yeah, there was a Republican primary in Georgia yesterday where Marjorie Taylor Greene won the primary. And she is notable. I mean, it's a safe seat. So a Republican, it's a safe Republican seat. So the Republican nominee is going to represent that seat after the general election, presumably. And the reason Greene's victory has gotten so much attention is that she has had kind of this affiliation or this, you know, connection to the conspiracy theory group QAnon, and this is a very kind of complicated conspiracy group that's predominantly takes place online that the FBI has labeled as a domestic terrorism threat. And so her connections to this group is something that we'll probably start hearing a lot more about. There will probably be a lot of Democratic criticism of some of the things she's saying. There were some Republicans who are frustrated with her victory because they're worried about things that she says and things that she has said becoming kind of an albatross around Republicans' necks and something that Democrats are going to point to as evidence of kind of the extremist nature of the Republican Party. This is a dynamic we saw in Iowa with Steve King. He was someone who has said that he basically has expressed sympathy for white supremacy explicitly and has kind of enmeshed himself in a whole bunch of different problematic things. And so he was someone that Republicans were eager to get out of their party, and he lost his primary recently, and Republicans were thankful for that, or a lot of, you know, top Republicans were, because they could kind of start to shed this image of the party having these connections to some of these fringe and extremist elements. But now with her victory, that is again going to possibly be a problem for the Republican Party.
Closer to home in Minnesota, Democrat Ilhan Omar faced a primary challenge, and she won that one. Again, this got a lot of attention. Talk us through this race in our last minute or so.
Yeah, so she, Representative Omar, won her primary, and this was closely watched because her opponent had raised a pretty significant amount of money, and there was a fair amount of momentum, it seemed like, behind him. He had been critical of basically Representative Omar's national standing. She is someone who has, you know, been very vocal as a very actively liberal member of the so-called squad. She has also had drawn a fair amount of controversy in terms of some of the things she said about some of the Democratic parties and congressional relationship with Israel. And so he basically ran as someone who said that, you know, our representative should not be such a national figure, should not be someone who's embroiled in so much controversy. And he raised a whole lot of money doing so, but still fell short. So it was kind of seen as an early litmus test or another litmus test of kind of how, you know, local constituents feel when their representatives become these kind of national figureheads for broader ideological causes.
Andy, thanks again for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
That's Wall Street Journal congressional reporter Andy Duren. He joined us for a look at some of the week's top stories in national politics, including reactions to presumptive Democratic presidential nominee Joe Biden picking California Senator Kamala Harris to be his running mate, as well as the coronavirus recovery stalemate in Congress. And as you heard there, a couple primary results in Georgia and Minnesota. Later in the show, we're going to talk more about the vice president this pick this week, but also big changes in the role of the vice president as running mate, and from going to a non-figure into the White House to a pretty important figure. We'll talk about how the vice presidency has changed over time. That's coming up later here on Central Time. Picture this scene. You're hanging around the house wearing the Roman general's outfit worn by Russell Crowe in Gladiator, but with the boots and jacket worn by Susan Sarandon in Thelma and Louise. And you're doing some household repairs using a sonic screwdriver from Doctor Who. But wait, this dream scene doesn't have to live on only in your imagination. It can all be yours for $25,000 plus or minus. A huge auction in Los Angeles later this month is selling off hundreds of movie props, costumes, design, drawings, and more. Everything from a schematic for E.T.'s spaceship to a Cylon helmet prototype from the first version of Battlestar Galactica. A lot of Hollywood classics and not-so-classics are represented. Ron Burgundy's pale blue suit, the watch Robin Williams wore in Good Will Hunting, a servo-operated puppet from Gremlins 2, Howard the Duck's jacket, Katniss Everdeen's bow, the catalog goes on for hundreds of pages. How am I going through life without owning this stuff? Well, I better figure it out, because I'm going to keep on not owning this stuff. Every item I just mentioned has estimated bids in the four-digit range, except for the ones that go up to five digits. And I'm guessing that Wisconsin Public Radio doesn't have a budget line this year for Cylon helmets. Just a hunch. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.